As Paul said, we have come to the end of our study through the book of Matthew this year, and it has been a remarkable time. What would you think, what would you do if you heard, if I announced this morning, there was a resurrection over at the cemetery on Broad River? Yeah. Well, some time ago, there was a resurrection and the front page of the Jerusalem Times announced it. I would like to take up this morning Matthew chapter 28, and under these three headings, the women, the authorities, and the disciples. The chapter, I think, falls naturally into those divisions, and I will go through, if I may, one at a time. Matthew selects from a great number of events that happened after the resurrection, and I will sometimes fill in the text, in parentheses, some details from the other Gospels to fill out the sequence of events. So let me read the chapter in these three parts. First, the women at the tomb in verses 1 through 10. After the Sabbath, at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. The angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He has risen just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples he has risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you." So the women hurried from the tomb, afraid and filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly, Jesus met them. "Greetings," he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshiped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me." All right, let's pause and look at that text for a moment and begin at the beginning. After the Sabbath, at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary and Salome, we are told, went to look at the tomb and anoint the body. All right? It was customary for rich families to have a family tomb. And so this was the case, apparently, in this case of Jesus, that Joseph of Arimathea had a family tomb, and it was a new tomb, and he was going to have Jesus buried there. I don't know why it wasn't in Arimathea. That would seem to be the logical place. Maybe the family had moved to Jerusalem recently, and he was still known as Joseph of Arimathea. But anyway, we don't know. But the tomb apparently was near Jerusalem, because that's what we are told elsewhere. The women are walking to the tomb, and they're saying to one another, "Who's going to roll the stone away for us? We're not strong enough." Let me show you some tombs, real tombs, outside Jerusalem or in that area. Here's one. And you can see that it's an opening into the side of the rock, an opening that has been cut into the side of the rock. But when you go in there, you may be surprised to find something like this. You are in a pretty large room, and around the sides of the room are cut slots in the wall. And on the right side, you can see there is a kind of table. And that's a work table where the body would be laid, and it would be wrapped with linen strips, and the spices would be put in between the layers of linen. So that would be the work table, the preparation table. And then the body would be put into one of these slots. And it would be left in the slot for possibly up to a year. And the flesh would disintegrate, and the bones would be pulled out and washed and put in a bone box. Most of us have heard the word ossuary. Well, that's an ossuary, a bone box. So the bones would be put in the bone box, and then the bone box would be stored somewhere in the tomb. And presumably the person's name would be put on the box. So when, for example, here's an example. Peter and John came to the tomb. And John got there first, and he bent over and looked in. See, because the opening's not very big. You don't want a real big opening, because then you have a real big stone that you have to push across the opening. And so you have a small opening. It goes into a larger cavern, and in the cavern you have these various features. Have you ever wondered why we do not have in the Gospels a record of the funeral of Jesus? Because it hadn't taken place. Because, see, I'm trying to reconstruct in my mind what happened, and what we are told that Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus carried, or had their men carry, the body of Jesus to the tomb, and his body would be put on that table arrangement, and they carried with them 75 pounds of spices and the linen wrappings. Now, they were right up against the Sabbath. It was probably too late to actually do the wrapping with the spices. And so they would, I think, leave the body there to have the spices applied. So then the next day is the Sabbath. Can't do it on Sabbath because their rules said we don't do that on Sabbath. The women came pretty close to, they got there pretty close to dawn. They left home at dark. They got there pretty close to dawn the next morning after the Sabbath, on the Sunday morning, and they have come. I think what has happened is they've been told, look, we had time to take the body to the tomb. We've left everything there, and the stones rolled over the door. But somebody needs to go and prepare the body. Somebody needs to go and wrap the body and apply the spices. And so the women come there early in the morning, and that is the scene that we have before us. Now, I think there's one, if I may, just a parenthesis at this point. There's one other question we need to take up, and that is the question of 3 days in the tomb. If Jesus was crucified on Friday, and he rose on Sunday, like early Sunday morning, how do we get 3 days in the tomb? So here are Jesus' words. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Okay? But he wasn't in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights. So how do we explain that? Well, I have heard theories. I mean, I've heard enough theories to fill a book. I have seen charts with different Passover dates and all kinds of stuff. I mean, that would blow your mind. And it almost blew mine. If Jesus was put in the tomb late Friday afternoon, right? And he's taken out he's raised from the dead early Sunday morning, 36 hours, maybe? That's not 3 days and three nights. Well, after hearing all these theories, I am a believer in Occam's razor. Do you kids know what Occam's razor is? Occam's razor is the theory that the simplest explanation is probably the right one. Well, there are two things that we can say about Jewish timekeeping. Number one, that when they said a day and a night, they meant it was an expression. It was an idiom, right? If it was not necessarily that what they were talking about was took up that whole period of 24 hours. Second thing is that they had they would say that something happened for 3 days when in fact it only occupied a small part of any one of those days or any two of those days. So there's a lot of flexibility as far as time is concerned. But bottom line, Jesus was dead. He was in the tomb for 36 hours. He was confirmed dead. Nobody's going to leave someone alive in a tomb. He was confirmed dead. The stone was put over the entrance, and the women came on Sunday morning, and he's already been raised. All right, here we go, verse 2. Before the women arrived, this is what we learned from elsewhere, there was a violent earthquake. For an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. There was an earthquake. Apparently there was an earthquake before dawn on Sunday morning. Matthew Henry, the great commentator, has a wonderful expression on this. He says, remember there was an earthquake when Jesus was on the cross, right? Here's what Henry says. When he died, the earth shook for fear. Now it leaped for joy. Isn't that nice? This was the defeat of death. And we are told elsewhere that in the last day, when the dead are raised, there's going to be more than an earthquake. There's going to be turmoil on the surface of the earth. The earth shook, and Jesus came out from the dead. The angel rolled away the stone. When the guards who were left at the tomb saw the angel, they shook. But Jesus came out alive. I don't mean to be trite, but sometimes when God appears, he shakes things up, right? Back to the women, verse 5. The angel said to the women, "Don't be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He has risen. Just as he said, come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples, he has risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you." So the women hurried away from the tomb. afraid yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. All right. So this was an angel. Mark tells us Mark calls him a young man. It was apparently an angel who looked like a young man. And Luke tells us there were two of them. Probably Matthew and Luke refer to the one who spoke, and the other one was just his partner. And the angel says these three things. Don't be afraid. He learned that at angel training school. Anytime you get an assignment to go to speak to people on earth, the first thing you must say is, don't be afraid. Because they're going to be shocked. And then he says, come and see where they laid him. Come and see where he lay. Now, he could have said, he is risen. He's gone. It's finished. But he didn't. He said, come and see the evidence. Come and see the empty tomb. Come and see where he lay. Because they then could see with their own eyes. And when they were sent to the disciples, they could tell them what they had seen. Because that's the third thing he says to them. Go and tell his disciples. So these women were the first messengers of the resurrection. So they're leaving the tomb, and we read at verse 9, suddenly Jesus met them. Greetings, he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshiped him. Then Jesus said to them, don't be afraid. The angel had said that, and now the shock of seeing Jesus himself, he says it. Don't be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and there they will see me. If they thought they had seen something already, now they see Jesus himself. Now they see the Lord himself. Now they see the one they had known and the one they had been with, the one they had traveled with. It's a remarkable thing that after the resurrection, Jesus does not just come out of the grave, get with the disciples, and stay with them for 40 days. It doesn't happen. He appears to them. He appears to them about 9 or 10 times. This is one of the appearances. This is not, as in some cases, a supernatural appearance. He doesn't come through a door, but where has he been? Has he been standing back there among the grapevines or behind a tree and observing the women as they saw the empty tomb? Maybe. But he comes up to them and he says, don't be afraid. And they fall down on the ground and clasp his feet. Clasp his feet. Now, I think he can make two points from that. The one point Matthew makes, they worshiped him. They're clasping his feet in worship. They're just so overwhelmed. But the other thing is, they're clasping his feet. They're real. They're flesh and blood. Jesus has really risen from the dead. The body has come out of the tomb. This isn't a made-up story. Who would make a story like this if it were not true? This is for real. We can have confidence in the historicity of the resurrection. We can have confidence that Jesus rose from the dead. That's the story of the women. Now we turn to the authorities. And we begin at verse 11 and read this. While the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say, 'His disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep.' If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed, and this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. Now, when I read that, I feel as if I've been taken down from heaven and put down on earth. This is the kind of thing that happens on earth. This is the kind of thing that happens with earth people. The women took the news to the disciples, and the guards brought the news to the officials. Imagine these guards. They come up to the officials and they say, "The body's gone." They were given the easiest assignment anybody had ever been given: guard a dead body. And they had to come and say, "The body's gone." That was their responsibility. And they failed in their responsibility. I don't know whether with the angel and the earthquake and the tomb opening, and it would take a minute maybe for Jesus to come out. I don't know whether the guards had already gone. They were so scared of the earthquake and the angel, or whether they were the first to see the risen Christ. I don't know. But they turned out to be ideal witnesses to the resurrection, number one, because they saw what they saw with their own eyes. Number two, because they had no reason to deceive. They admitted the body was gone. And thirdly, they told the leaders plainly that the body was gone. These were guards from the temple police, and they're reporting to the Jewish authorities, and they just say up front, "We failed. The body's gone." Excuse me. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan. Now, I was speaking here a few weeks ago about an earlier account, and one of the statements in that earlier account was, the chief priests got together and devised a plan on how they were going to kill Jesus. Now they're devising a plan on how to keep him dead. I hope this is not too crude, but I have come to call them the Jewish mafia. Those guys are so far from God. And they gave the soldiers a large sum of money. They had paid Pilate they had paid Judas to betray Jesus, and now they're giving the soldiers a large sum of money. And they say to them, "You're to tell people that his disciples came and beat you guys off and stole the body." And if this report gets to the governor, they say, "We'll cover your back. We got you. You won't get in trouble for failing your mission." So the soldiers took the money and did what they were told to do. And Matthew says, Matthew was written between 25 and 35 years later. Matthew says, They did as they were instructed, and this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. He was a little surprised. Matthew, it's still circulating. The story's still going around that the disciples stole the body. So they devised a plan. They said, wait here, we're going to have a little meeting. And they went in and had a meeting, and they devised a plan. They came out, they gave him a big bribe. And they said, we'll cover you if the word gets to the governor. And they took the money and did what they were told. Here's William Barclay's comment on that. Listen to this. The leaders used treachery to lay hold on him. They used illegality to try him. They used slander to charge him. And now they were using bribery to silence the truth about him. Is that bad? Whew. Jesus said, if the world hates you, remember it hated me first. These people hated the Son of God. Jesus tells the parable of the landowner who leased his land to tenants, and then he sent his servants to collect the rent. And some they abused and some they killed. They just gave him a bad time. And finally he said, I've got to send my son. So he sent his son. This parable is so transparent. Finally he sent his son, and you know what they did to the son? Killed him and said, maybe we'll get the vineyard. Maybe we'll get the land. That's what's happening here. Now, we've come down to verse 15. A great deal happens between verses 15 and 16. There are about seven or eight other appearances of Jesus when he reveals himself to people. And we come to, in verse 16, the disciples on the hillside. Reading from verse 16. The 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. And when they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. So the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain. And when they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. Now I'm tempted to think that what happens is that Jesus is approaching. Maybe Jesus is there first, and they're approaching, and they're at a distance, and they begin to recognize him, but some doubt that it's really him. Like, that would give them the benefit of the doubt. The other way to interpret it is to say, yeah, they saw him, but they still didn't believe in the resurrection. These are the 12 guys Jesus is going to leave to evangelize the world. I'll get to that in a minute. But it seems to me that if these disciples were in a position where there was real doubt. There was real doubt about the resurrection. And they were to be the apostles sent out with a mission to evangelize the world. That they still have a little bit of room in their minds for doubt, in their hearts for doubt. If you experience doubt, we all sit here with, I was going to say smiling faces, but I don't see everybody smiling. We sit here with our holy faces on Sunday morning, but is there a doubt? Is there any doubt in any heart? Is there any doubt in any mind? Don't let that discourage you. Work through it. Pray through it. Read through it. Seek counsel through it. God revives doubters. God can answer your doubts. He's able. He has the ability. He can answer your doubts. Don't be discouraged by your doubts. Verse 18. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. What would you do if all authority on heaven and on earth was given to you? And trust the evangelization of the world to these 12 guys?" I don't know. I don't know if I would. But Jesus did. "Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." This was Jesus' plan, to send these 12 to the world to carry his message. Luke said, "Theophilus, I wrote to you before about all that Jesus began to do and to teach." He's still doing and teaching. He's still there. If you go, I will be with you to the end of the age. If you go, I will be with you. If you go, I will be with you. If you go, I will be with you. Whatever, wherever, whenever. He promises his presence to the end of the age. Notice the contrast. The scheming politicians trying to maintain their power, and Jesus, who has all power, sending out these disciples. That's our commission too, that we are to go and tell. The women worshiped Jesus. The leaders tried to keep him in the grave. And the disciples were commissioned to carry the truth to the ends of the world. Now, I want to take a minute, if I may, to reflect. I want to reflect on Matthew as we have spent most of this year going through most of the past year going through Matthew's gospel. And I want to reflect, if I may, for just a minute on Matthew before I close. Author Thomas Bernard, I believe it was him who said that the Gospels are a seedbed of New Testament doctrine. They're the seedbed. The seed comes to fruition in the epistles, but the Gospels are the seedbed. And Luke, of course, as I said a minute ago, said to Theophilus all that Jesus began to do and teach, and Jesus is going to continue. His teaching was in the simplest, most natural terms. He talked about birds and crops. He talked about seed going into the ground. He talked about grapes on the vine. He talked about sheep and goats. He talked about all that. That's the kind of stuff he talked about. And he planted the seeds of New Testament doctrine. And then the apostles developed them. Jesus does two things in his teaching. He corrects their understanding of the Old Testament. These people had got so far from the truth of the Old Testament that they crucified him. They crucified the Son of God. And Jesus, in his teaching, tries to correct excuse me for using the word try, tries to correct their view of the Old Testament. But then he does something else. He presents the truth of the New Testament. He presents new truth. He develops the truth into new truth. And here is how I have come to see the role of the book of Matthew as we have gone through it this time. I take Exodus and Romans to be more or less symbolic of the Old and New Testaments. Exodus says, if you obey these laws, you will be blessed by God. All right, keep the law. It gives the law and it says, keep the law. And Romans says, you have the freedom of the Spirit and you are to live out the fruit of the Spirit in your life. You're to live out what the Spirit does in your life. We're not under the law. The Jews were under the law. We are not under the law. And Paul hammers at that again and again and again because it's such a powerful theme. The law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. And Jesus, in Matthew's gospel, I believe, forms the bridge between the old and the new. So my last word is this. I encourage you to come back again and again to the teaching of Jesus himself, to listen to his words, because he commissioned his disciples in the end, teach them to obey everything I have taught you. May the Lord help us as we do that.